You're listening to the Today in Manufacturing podcast.
Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me this week are Jeff Ranke and Anna Wells. We each have more than 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we cover the five most popular stories on our websites and discuss the implications they have on the industry moving forward. Before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You could also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. We're also live every Thursday, so subscribe to us on YouTube at IEN Magazine so you can get a notification every time we go live. You could also subscribe to our daily and weekly newsletters. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. Jeff, how you doing? Are you more excited because you know you're going to be out next week?
No, I'm looking for a bounce back episode, seeing as how I was 180 degrees off on the whole UAW situation last week. So hopefully I can improve my performance.
That's what happens. You know, that's what happens with podcasting. You put yourself out there and then like 5 hours later, it's just like, you know what? I think it's going to be long and drawn out.
Yeah.
It's come to a conclusion by Saturday morning.
We're good.
Anna, how are you doing this week?
Doing well, thanks.
All right. Well, before we jump into our first story this week, we have a word from our new sponsor. One of the long-lasting impacts of COVID-19 and the global pandemic it created has been the priority now being placed on long-term enterprise-wide planning. So you can join me and Jeff Ranke. That's
me.
That's him.
That's me.
And we're going to discuss Oracle NetSuite's newest white paper, The Ultimate Guide to Scenario Planning. You can hear about new strategies and steps that you can use to de-risk your organization. You can click the link to register below in the comments section. If we're even live streaming right now, we're having like a bandwidth issue right now. So if you're joining us on YouTube, thanks for sticking around. All right. Well, our first story this week. UAW says strike, quote, won things no one thought possible. It has been a good week for the United Auto Workers. The union won at least partial victories on many of the key demands that led to the six-week strike against Ford, GM, and Stellantis. Now, rank and file UAW members must ratify each contract before they take effect. But UAW president said, quote, hey, we won things no one thought possible. Here are the key terms. A 25% pay increase by April 2028, raising top pay to about $42 an hour. It starts with an 11% boost upon ratification, three annual raises of 3% each, and a final increase of 5%. The restoration of cost of living increases, which were suspended in 2009 and could boost the total increases to more than 30%. The union initially asked for 40% increases, if you recall. It also includes $5,000 ratification bonuses, temp workers who will get pay raises totaling 150% over the life of the deal. They'll also get ratification bonuses and profit sharing starting next year. Traditional pension plans were panned. They were nixed, but they agreed to increase 401k contributions by about 9.5%. The UAW didn't get the 32-hour work week that I was hoping for, but Ford and GM agreed to end wage tiers, and the agreement shortens the time it will take workers to reach top scale, shorten it to 3 years. It previously took 8 years under the contract that expired in September. Anna, your thoughts on the somewhat abrupt conclusion of this strike, or wind down, I guess, of this strike, because it's not over, but it's like nearing the end, and some of the terms that the UAW was able to land for its, brotherhood.
Yeah. I mean, if you recall last week, I did predict that it would be abrupt.
Yeah.
It was Jeff. Would take a while.
Thanks for pointing that out, Anna.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
I know that you already pointed it out, but I thought maybe a second time.
I just want to throw some more dirt on it.
Maybe a second time.
Dive right in.
Would be appropriate.
Man.
Yeah, this was a momentous deal with the big three. As you explored there in your bullet points, a lot of really exciting concessions that were made by the auto companies for these workers. And you can see why everybody's pretty amped up. I do think that what's pretty exciting about this, too, or foreboding, depending on what side you're on of this, is some of the downstream impacts that we're going to see and are already seeing based on this momentous deal. So perhaps most notable, just within a few days of this, Toyota announced that it would be raising wages for its non-union workers by nearly 10%, which was a, I think, very transparent response to the big three deals and a decisive indication that I think a rising tide raises all boats in this case. Reports say that this brings Toyota's top scale workers in its Kentucky plant, for example, to nearly $35 an hour. These are non-union workers again. I think what's funny is that in the future, I think there'll be plenty of people down the line, you know, our memories are so short on this stuff that we'll point to these high non-union wages as evidence that you don't need unions. But so yeah. Really the unions are, you know, should be credited for getting this for these workers. But they also, Toyota, to just to give you an example of how transparent it is that they were kind of falling into line with these agreements, they also cut the time it takes for workers to reach top tier status from 8 years. They went down to 4. Mm-hmm. But again, just to be competitive with this offer. Otherwise, I don't think these auto companies are going to be in a very good position if they don't. So what's next? Sean Fain, in this article, referred to the future and saying, you know, someday it's not going to be the big three, it's going to be the big 4, 5, or 6. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he's making a statement there that he's going to be trying to run down some of these other automakers, Honda, Toyota, Tesla.
Yeah.
There are reports that in Fremont, there's 20,000 non-union workers at Tesla's Fremont plant, and that they were holding some meetings coming up with some organization-type committees.
Mm-hmm.
We know that one's a tough nut to crack. Elon Musk has in the past sort of subtly threatened workers with, you know, taking away their stock options if they unionize, things like that.
While simultaneously inviting them to talk.
Yeah. That culture, I think, and sentiment is not as amenable to organization as maybe some of the other plants that they could go after first. But we'll see. I mean, it certainly is going to embolden the UAW to try to spread this around automotive, and we'll see what kind of downstream effects that has, whether it's the automakers making these decisions on their own to kind of raise wages, or if some of these workers are going to be more compelled to listen to this message from the UAW.
Is Toyota trying to be more competitive in the workforce, or are they trying to just hold off UAW influence in their plants?
I think probably both of those things. Yeah.
Yeah.
This has been what they do. This is how they've basically avoided unionizing, having their employees unionized. They just follow the trends and point out there's no need.
Yeah, there's no need. We're taking care of you in the same vein as the union does. And so why pay union dues? We'll just pay you what they're, or close to what they're making. So, I mean, it works.
Just to clarify,
works.
Anna, not that I'm saying you were wrong.
Yeah.
But Toyota did a 9.2%. Increase.
Oh, okay. Did I? What did I say?
Rounded up.
Almost 10. So I just wanted to clarify. I'm not saying, you know.
When does it become almost 10? 9.2. It's almost 10.
Over 9.
Well, it's 9.2.
While we're on the subject of wrong, for historical comparison, the union said its workers saw pay increases of 23% for all of the years between 2001 through 2022. Now we're looking at 30% with everything, when everything is said and done. And Jeff, you know, sometimes we make bold predictions and sometimes, you know, they land. Sometimes they don't. But I mean,
Are we going to let this go or no? You're just going to stick on this? I mean, I admitted I was wrong.
I'm going to stick on it for the sake of a transition.
Yeah, you.
Yeah, I feel like you're ganging up on me.
We wanted a chance. We wanted a chance to admit that you were wrong. So.
Oh, I see.
It's
whatever I can do for you.
Embrace it. Okay. Embrace it, Jeff. No, but I mean, you must have been surprised to see the news come just a day later after recording the podcast.
Thanks for that's a great transition, David.
You're welcome
for setting me up.
Mm-hmm.
I think the pay stuff is fantastic. That's, yeah. And I will always advocate for people getting paid as much as they possibly can. I think you brought up a great point there in terms of this being a 30% increase, whereas they saw a 23% increase for the last previous 20 years, basically.
Yeah.
If you give me a lot of credit there, we didn't see any movement in the other areas, though. A little bit on the benefits. There was a ratification bonus, which is kind of standard. They did initially talk about a bonus also for retired employees, which I didn't see covered here.
Yeah.
I would like to learn a little bit more about that, if it's some sort of revenue related gain or what the dynamic is there. But everything else feels like it really fell in line with what you'd see from a traditional manufacturing worker, whether they're union or non-union. So it's interesting. See, we didn't see movement on the work week. We didn't see stuff with pensions, all of that. So I think UAW, you know, getting back to where Anna was going in terms of looking at Toyota, Tesla, VW, Mitsubishi, I think are the other big ones, Honda, they've got a window here. Okay, Fain really did a good job in terms of getting this settled, and the way it came down so abruptly, basically, I think did really give him a lot of clout in terms of maybe having going to some of these other facilities and having a little bit stronger message for people to listen to him. I think what's interesting is when you look at a lot of these other plants or these other manufacturers, automakers, the only one that really operates in states that are not right to work is Toyota. So when you look at BMW, they've got the big facility in South Carolina. When you look at VW, it's Tennessee. Again, these are right to work states, so there's not as strong of a union presence. And really, I think the culture in these facilities has not been, in the past, receptive. They just don't see the need for it. However, when you look at Toyota, one of their biggest manufacturing hubs is California. Definitely a very union-friendly state. Missouri is another big one. When you look at Tesla, they still have a big facility out in Fremont. So there is another opportunity there, because I think you've got the combination of, if the workers want it, you've also got a politically friendly environment. Whereas when you get to the southeastern part of the country, not so much. So I think there'll be added pressure potentially when you try to go to some of these other facilities and some of these other companies that are not operating in non-right-to-work states to try to approve a union. I think that's a real uphill battle for UAW there. But again, they've got this window here, and how they're going to approach that is going to be really important. I think he needs to continue to sort of stand the pulpit a little bit and preach the things that were gained. Toyota made a really smart move in coming back and increasing those worker wages right there. I also think one of the big things that it's not really being talked about as much as I think as it should is a big part of this agreement was, was some of the stuff that came about with the electric vehicle dynamic.
Oh, yeah.
Union said Ford agreed to put workers at a future battery plant in Michigan under the UAW's master contract, and GM agreed to do the same with the Ultium cells?
Yeah, Ultium,
a joint venture between the company and LG Energy Solution of South Korea. So I think those are really big initial steps, because as they expand the EV footprint at all of these companies, which I thought would hold up these talks, if they can put these things in place going forward, that's a huge win for the UAW.
No, it was, I was surprised with what he was able to accomplish. And I wonder if we're going to get anything more from behind the scenes as to how it happened, just because it did seem like it was going to be a little bit more drawn out. But I mean, I did like his sort of plain spoken approach. Like, this is what we're going to do. This is exactly how we're going to do it. And, you know, they called him for about 6 weeks on whether or not he would. And then Fain executed. And then all of a sudden we had a slew of deals and a random automaker also raised wages as a result. So it was very interesting to see. Anna, do you think that it does any sort of like brand damage to like Ford or GM? One thing I was curious about is that, you know, in all these reports, you always see like Jeep maker Stellantis. So I wondered if there's like enough people still don't know what Stellantis is.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, does it do damage to GM or Ford, or is it on the other end where it looks good because, you know, it wasn't a long drawn out process? They sort of met in the middle. They're seen a little bit more worker friendly. I don't know. Or does it just wait until the price tag skyrockets and then the damage happens?
I mean, I don't think there would be brand damage. Everyone knows that these companies are very tied to their union workers and that this comes up every couple of years and it's always this way. I mean, there's not always a strike, but it's always a contentious discussion. And that's just sort of the nature of the business. I did not like Sean Fain's style, by the way. just to respond to your comment on that.
What didn't you care about?
Well, and, you know, like I'll eat crow on this, too. I thought that he was going to be I did not think he was the right person for the job at the beginning of this because he was so aggressive. And I just didn't see that that was going to work out well in terms of like being a mediator, a negotiator.
He wasn't a mediator. Like, I think that's why he's the talking head.
Yeah, he's the face. And then,
yeah, you have the like negotiators behind the scene.
Right.
Where they're just like, all right, there's the bluster. Now let's talk numbers.
Right. But the bluster to me was too much. Okay. It was like to the point of ridicule. I mean, throwing people's contracts in the garbage on YouTube.
Yeah.
You know, that's what he did to Stellantis. I mean, that's like, to me, it was like so outrageous that I could see that being more of a problem than a solution.
Yeah.
Obviously, in the end, it did work out for the UAW. So obviously, this is not something I should do for a job because I don't would not be good at it. But yeah, I don't know. He was not my favorite flavor of this, but I don't know what would be. I mean,
well, let's see if it translates to representation at other automakers. You know, I mean, yeah. maybe it only fits a niche audience. And as they try to move into other facilities, they just can't because, you know,
that's where the brand reputation is most at risk. It's with the UAW in terms of how they handle it. Because, yeah, Sean Fain definitely rubbed some people the wrong way throughout this process. He got the result they were going for, which really it feels like the automakers were sort of calling his bluff in terms of is he just all talk and no action? Because what they came back with and what they settled on seems very reasonable for all involved. Like, why did it take 6 weeks to get to this when it basically came down to pay, which they were deserving of.
Didn't it take so long because like he started at 40 and they countered with 9?
Yeah, that was before the discussion started. That's where they were. They were really far apart. But
you mentioned possible action at Tesla. Business Insider has been covering that quite a bit, talking to a lot of anonymous workers. A lot of people at Tesla don't think that unionization efforts will work at Tesla because they think they still work in a sort of a startup culture where, I mean, they kind of describe more of a, like a dog eat dog sort of scenario where everyone's working to kind of like jockey for advancement within the facility. They also kind of talked about where like, you know, people that would be traditionally union friendly would be smoked out during the interview process. So I found that interesting that they're still UAW organizing efforts that are happening at the Tesla factory. They also interviewed a number of Tesla workers that said they wouldn't join a unionized company and that the UAW would struggle at Tesla. So I'm interested to see if Tesla becomes a target for the UAW just because it might be the most difficult road forward. All right, our next most popular story this week. Michelin to wind down Oklahoma tire production and cut 1,400 jobs. According to the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association, the annual economic footprint of U.S. tire manufacturing is more than $170 billion. And the industry employs 291,000 workers in manufacturing, distribution, and retail. Last week, Michelin announced that it is winding down tire making operations in Ardmore, Oklahoma, eliminating 1,400 jobs. Some tire production will be moved to Michelin's other North American plants, and Ardmore will continue to offer rubber mixing. The cuts will begin next year, and the wind down will be completed by 2025. The company says the Ardmore facility, which has produced passenger tires for 53 years, is not equipped to, quote, deliver tires at competitive costs to meet the North American market's evolving demands. And, Your thoughts on what happened in Oklahoma, as well as the current state of tire production in the United States.
So the company said that it, quote, carefully explored every other option before resolving this decision. I mean, we've seen that scenario play out so many times in so many other ways. But you do kind of wonder that if you really wanted this plant to work, you probably could have made it work. Many of the plants in this company's network. So Michelin has like 30 something operating locations in America. And many of them have no doubt been retooled or automated, over the years. That's pretty common stuff with factories. I think what's more likely here is that they probably had to select some plants to cull because demand in the tire industry is wavering a little bit. So the U.S. Tire Manufacturers Association predicts that tire sales will actually contract next year. And they say that that's both reductions in sales to OEMs as well as replacement tires. So both sides of the coin. Modern Tire Dealer believes the tire market is slowing down because of a few reasons. One, they say, is that dealers way overstocked in time.
During the pandemic?
Yeah.
Oh,
and
okay.
They still have some inventory that they need to deplete. Not to mention, there's been some reduced demand for logistics post-pandemic because people are not buying everything online as they were.
Mm-hmm.
And then just some general economic softening. And I think keep in mind too that the tire industry is going to see any effects that hit the auto industry just down the line.
Yeah.
So, I think the other thing that we need to mention, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention just how much innovation is taking place in the tire industry.
Right.
There's been, cheaper alternatives to traditional tires. There's been like airless and solid tire innovations, puncture resistant stuff. New materials to replace rubber, which is a very volatile commodity and tends to drive prices up or create fluctuating prices in that. So to me, that has to be considered as a factor as well, because it's an industry that's very prone to disruption, I think, right now.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it makes sense that a company like Michelin would need to streamline a little bit and maybe look at, are there factories that are redundant? Is there a way to move some production over? If they wanted to retool and update this factory to make it more cost competitive, they could have done that. They are not doing that by choice.
Yeah. Is it the old wives' tale where, business is slow, so go start throwing buckets of nails out on the highway? Like, we got to start moving tires.
I have never heard that, but but maybe. What? Maybe
you've never heard that before?
Maybe that's their business model.
It's slow at the car shop, so just, get outside and throw some nails out there. Just me then.
Nope,
all right.
Just you.
Well, no. So I would say like, hey, I'm doing my part to help out the tire industry because if there's a nail on the road, I'm going to find it. And you're right. It's I'm struck by how the tire is changing as well. And I agree. You need to plan for further disruption just because, we're also talking about like not just solid tires, but like more futuristic looking like tires that can morph and the tread changes based on the condition. They're going to be much more expensive, but they're going to last a whole lot longer.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I personally, I'm excited by that just because I feel like the tire is always that commodity item where it is so expensive when you need to repair your car. But like, you have to do it. You know, it's just mm-hmm. like, hey, you caught a nail. You can let it slowly leak until you're stranded on the road with your kids, or we could fix it now for $1,500. Just like, because you can't just change one, Jeff.
Sure you can.
Well, no, because they got to be level, right? You got to have the like, you can't be off by that eighth inch or it throws your alignment off. I'm a sucker.
Yeah.
They got to be level.
They
see me coming.
They got you.
Yeah, they're like, he bought that filter. Get after him for four
just so
tires.
You know, David, you can patch tires too.
You can, but you always catch a nail in somewhere that's unpatchable. Oh, it's not. It's unpatchable. And you're just.
We got to talk about who you go to for this stuff.
I go to Toyota. Like I go. I feel like I should.
Yeah,
trust
them.
There it was.
Yeah,
I knew we could get the high pitched.
He's got some kind of response. Like knockoff Angie's List that's like
no.
cheaper and full of like grifters.
Yeah, well, at least they're extremely nice grifters that have free coffee and good Wi-Fi, so I can at least work.
Yeah.
Jeff, the tire industry is changing. Is this a sign of more things to come or just something that had to happen for Michelin to right size a bit?
I think it's a combination of things. Anna alluded to a lot of the different factors. You call it a commodity and I get why.
Yeah.
But tires aren't anymore. They're like a really critical part of the whole functionality of your vehicle right now. And when it comes to the chemistry that's involved in producing tires, it's not just make it round and rubber anymore.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different factors that are going into that, starting with supply chain. Rubber supply is difficult right now. Rubber is more expensive for all the reasons we've talked about for a lot of other raw materials. So that's definitely impacting costs. When you then look at what they're trying to do from a technology perspective in having more sustainable production approaches, using better materials that last longer. And then you're talking about a lot of different technology that's actually going into the tire, not just in the production, but tire pressure sensors and all of those types of things that are more data feeding into the car to help you drive it better.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look at the EV effect. Okay. EVs are heavier.
Yeah.
So there needs to be a different type of tire composition. So it wears evenly and you're not you know, you can still get that ultimate range out of your electric vehicle. So there's a lot of things that are going into it. And I think all of those factors combine to make a lot of these upgrades at a facility like this much more expensive, much more difficult than in the past. So I think Anna and I are kind of saying the same things, but I think this was a very straightforward decision in terms of, we got all this stuff to deal with. We're not going to invest in another plant. We're just going to shift this work to someplace where either it's easier to upgrade or we've already made all these adjustments. Yeah. And unfortunately, it is sad because this is a town I want to save about 2,500 people or 25,000 people.
Yeah.
So losing 1,400 jobs, that's a huge deal.
And very suddenly.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's interesting too. You know, all of the headlines were town officials and state officials even saying we didn't see this coming. It came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
I think they should be very grateful that Michelin – not grateful. They should at least recognize that Michelin has given them a year and a half.
Yeah, it's a lot of lead.
To transition there. And you can see a lot of things proactively taking place in terms of how do we uptrain these people and dealing with local tech schools and universities even to adapt these folks and get them into a better situation for their career path going forward. I think Oklahoma is actually, as a state, has done a lot better job too in some of the research I was doing in terms of growing their appeal to manufacturing and bringing them into the state. There's a lot of unused space in Oklahoma that if you're looking to either build or expand your operations, it's a very friendly state for that. So hopefully when you take all the things that they're doing in terms of getting ahead of the situation, Oklahoma being very manufacturing friendly, uptraining employees, you know, hopefully they've got enough time to compensate for this loss of jobs.
No, I thought that was very wishful thinking. Only because they were just like, so they created this task force to help the 1,400 impacted employees find other jobs or whatever. That's what they're going to do. I was curious as to, will that be useful? Because the other pitch that they had out there was like, hey, we have a huge workforce. If you just want to set up shop here, you know, it's kind of like turnkey. And I'm like, it's possible, but like improbable to, you know.
Well, you look at this area though. I mean, Panasonic's building that huge facility in Kansas. Oklahoma was up for that as well. There is more people looking in that part of the country because land's cheaper, taxes are lower, labor rates are lower, and now you've got potentially, however you want to train these folks, the local educational facilities are hand-in-hand with the state. Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm maybe a little more optimistic than you.
Well, no, I mean, I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic that they have a skill set that will translate to other manufacturing jobs that we know are available right now. It's to whether or not they're available in the immediate area. And it's unfortunate that I feel like we're saying that a lot lately. But I mean, a lot of people, one of the quotes that I pulled out was Ardmore Chamber of Commerce President and CEO William Murphy told Fox Business, the Ardmore Chamber of Commerce was stunned to learn the news of Michelin's plan to begin winding down tire production at the Ardmore facility over the next 2 years. The plan has been an anchor not only in Ardmore, but throughout Southern Oklahoma's economy, providing hundreds of well-paying jobs for more than 50 years. It's hard when you have a legacy company in a town like that, and all of a sudden they go away, and there are generations of families tied to that legacy that just all of a sudden gone within. And I know it seems like they have a long time, but like a year and a half goes fast. William Brent is watching us live. He says, you won't need tires when you have flying cars. Well, no, I mean, to have a flying car, it needs tires. To be an eVTOL, you don't need tires.
There you go.
All right. Semantics with Today in Manufacturing and William Brent. All right. Our next most popular story this week, Baby Products. A baby products startup founded by actors files for bankruptcy. Actors, possibly Brad Pitt. We're not sure. We'll see. Unconditional Love, which does business as Hello Bello, is a diaper and baby products company founded by actors Kristen Bell and Dax Shepard. Oh, well, maybe Brad Pitt. We're not sure about Brad Pitt. Now, the company recently filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, citing higher shipping costs, increased purchase prices, and delayed shipment of raw materials. The company listed estimated assets and liabilities of at least $100 million, with at least 200 creditors. One of the creditors is Irving Consumer Products, a tissue manufacturer that claims to be owed more than $22 million. On the same day it announced the bankruptcy, the company said it had agreed in principle to be acquired by Hildred Capital Management, a healthcare-focused private equity company, in a deal worth $65 million. The Married Actors founded the company in 2019 and reached 130,000 subscription customers and about $200 million in annual net sales by 2021. But the rise of global shipping costs and inflation outpaced the company's ability to maintain its growth at steady margins. The company first sold its eco-friendly products exclusively at Walmart and direct-to-consumer via its website. In its first 2 years, the company made all of its products via third-party co-manufacturers, but began making its own diapers once it opened a factory in 2021 in Texas. The company currently has plants in Mexico, Canada, China, and the U.S. Hello Bello has about 334 full-time workers in the United States. They will stay on and continue to receive wages and benefits. Jeff, your thoughts on a company that really came into a diaper industry that was ready for disruption and seemed to peter out as a result of unexpected economic conditions?
I think it was ready for disruption in terms of the business model, but I mean, the product's the product, mm-hmm. right? I mean, obviously as somebody who hasn't changed a diaper in a while, I can appreciate the differences and that can go into that and making sure it's performing like it should. Mm-hmm. But I think this is a situation where the business model, that subscription-based model, really did help them grow, especially when you're looking at a company that started in 2019, right before the pandemic, and then was available through this model to get stuff sent right to your door for 2 years. You can see how they were able to grow so steadily. And I think this is a situation where this rapid growth led to some rather quick decisions based on an economy that was sort of operating in a vacuum at that point.
Yeah.
And when they made the decision, I think, to get away from their contract manufacturer, start doing it themselves, start now, they talked about being online and with Walmart exclusively. You can find this stuff pretty much anywhere now in terms of how they distribute it. I think they just grew too fast. They grew too quickly, too fast, and made decisions based on that weren't long-term, really, they weren't solid decisions long-term because things were going to change. I think it's really tricky, and I've heard about this numerous times from different companies. Maybe you guys have heard the same. Walmart is really tricky because when you get in with these huge retailers, yeah, it's great to get their breadth of market coverage, but then you're also beholden to them when it comes to pricing, mm-hmm. where you are. And if somebody goes in there and they see Pampers and Huggies and Loves, and then what's this other one? You know, that's difficult to combat, especially if you're buying diapers in the quantities that I remember. 5-10 cents, quarter difference, you're going to go with the cheapest one if it's a good brand name that you can trust, that they have a good reputation. I think they also may have gotten into some trouble here because they were trying to position this as a sustainable product, a premium product, but still maintain a lower price. Mm-hmm. That's hard.
There's a reason.
So you have to wonder, when you combine the fact that they brought on mass manufacturing in-house, dealing with all of the same distribution. I mean, they're talking about shipping costs escalating. Everybody's had to deal with that. I don't think it's fair to say that's why we got into trouble here. I think it was a combination of they made decisions on manufacturing and distribution based on what was happening in a very unique economic circumstance. They flew too close to the sun and this is what happens.
I don't know. I think that that's a very good reason for things not working out for them, because when you are talking about such tight margins, I'm that customer who's looking at those. It's like Pampers, that's 22 cents a diaper. Loves, that's 15 cents a diaper. Huggies, that's 23 cents a diaper. Hello Bello, that you could get to like 12 cents a diaper. And when you're doing that math and, you know, you try it at first and it's a good product, you like, I picked that product. I was a customer and I used it and it was a solid product. There is other competing, like more generic brands in Walmart that you don't want to put on your kid, in my opinion anyways. They have sensitive skin. But Hello Bello was a good competitor, and I think they tried kind of pushing prices down to an unsustainable level. But I don't know. So I think that if it was something like supply chain logistics, that could have done them in.
But that's not what's doing them in. It's the pricing below what you can sustain is what's doing them in.
True. Understood. Anna, your thoughts on what happened at Hello Bello?
Well, I was really annoyed when I read the statement from their CEO who wholeheartedly blamed macroeconomic trends, which has become the scapegoat for every single unpopular business decision that's taken place in the last 18 months. Because if you look at, I know that inflation has been difficult. I know there's been some supply chain challenges, but The reality is the job market is still incredibly strong. The U.S. Commerce Department just reported a couple days ago that the economy grew by an annualized rate of 4.9% in the third quarter, which is the strongest pace since 2021. Consumers are shrugging off rate hikes. They're still buying. Yeah. So to me, like this consistent refrain of blaming the economy and like the soft economy. I mean, yeah, it's hitting some businesses harder than others. But in general, I don't think that we're not seeing a huge dip in consumer purchasing. We're just not. So to me, that feels a little bit like blame shifting for some of these other challenges that may have taken place. One of the things that to me was maybe a factor that they weren't really talking about, but why would they, is I think that this company, so this is, you know, as Jeff said, this is a really established market, right? You have some really strong competition here, big names that people already know. They have really high margins compared to, say, a newcomer because they've been doing this for a long time. They have a lot of, brick and mortar, they manufacture in-house, all that stuff. I think that this company maybe took a gamble on the idea that they could take market share from those bigger companies because they could more effectively tell a story. They have these, you know, these people running the company that everybody already knows. They're these very well-liked celebrities. So to me, it was like almost a marketing play to break ground in this industry. And I guess, in my opinion, that's kind of like a high wire act to try to pull off, especially when your market segment is like, your competition is Huggies, Pampers, Johnson & Johnson, these huge companies. Another baby products company, The Honest Company, that also has a celebrity spokesperson mm-hmm. who's also very popular.
Who's that?
Jessica Alba.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I think like margins at the outset were probably very tight. And I agree with you, Jeff, that price-sensitive customers are going to be looking at every single option. I mean, Love's is usually the lowest cost brand out there, unless you're buying like a store brand, and Love's are cheap, man, and they're yeah. cheaper than Hello Bello, and they're all right next to each other on the shelves. And so I do think it becomes for a lot of people a commodity purchase because diapers are expensive. And I do think you're right. I think they probably took a boost from the fact that people were worried about stockouts during the pandemic. So they felt maybe like the subscription method was a little bit of insurance for them to make sure that they got their product. And then once that market condition was no longer a factor, then I think that they could have better leveraged their celebrity spokespeople. Maybe they thought that they would get more of a boost from that than they actually did. But in the end, you know, that didn't deliver.
Maybe it could only take them so far.
Right.
Like maybe they were already too far ahead of their skis. All right. Our next most popular story. Marines test robot goat with a rocket launcher. Marines with the Tactical Training and Exercise Control Group, along with the Marine Air Ground Task Force Training Command and the Office of Naval Research, recently tested a quadruped robotic platform referred to as a robotic goat. The robot is agile enough to move over rough terrain, all of which can be performed through the camera-equipped controller. In a video posted by the Defense Visual Information Distribution Service, a woman demoing the device mentions a larger version of the robot that wears a goat head mask while either growling, barking, or emitting a siren. It all prompted one Marine in attendance to say, "That thing is creepy, man." The goat has sensors on the front, underneath, and on the sides, and it can also carry various weapons systems mounted on its back. During the test completed in September, it fired an M72 light anti-tank weapon rocket launcher from the goat's back. Now, this is just a demo. A battlefield version of the goat will likely have improved battery life, optics, and the ability to maneuver over rough terrain. Jeff is the military guy on the panel. Your thoughts on the robot goat with a rocket launcher on its back?
I have many thoughts, but first I have to ask you, David, two questions.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll ask you the first one. I'll ask Anna the second one. First of all, why do you think they needed to put in there swaying suggestively as a feature? That just seems like a really weird thing to throw in there.
It caught me off guard as well.
Yeah.
Is
that like an ergonomic benefit? I mean, what is that?
I would say maybe it wanted to show off its agility. That was one that struck me as well. Where, like yeah. swaying suggestively, like in some sort of intimidating robot goat. I mean, up until now, everyone's called it a robot dog. I don't understand why all of a sudden it's a robot goat.
As you say, isn't this,
because they put a goat mask on it.
Well,
now it's a
I know
robot
why
goat.
They did a goat. That was my question to Anna.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
But do you know why you do have an idea why the Marines would make this a goat?
No. Okay,
so the Marines don't like to admit this, mm-hmm. but they're actually part of the Navy. Okay. The Naval Academy's mascot is a goat.
Is this some...
I'm going to assume somewhere higher up the food chain.
At least that makes a lot more sense.
That connection is what I'm going to get.
They're just arbitrarily picking another...
Anyway. Are you like talking trash or something right now? Is this?
No, that's the actual Naval Academy's mascot. It's Billy the Goat.
Okay.
He's saying that they were talking trash.
So the Marines are kind of like kicking it to the Navy, I think, a little bit. Because they don't like to admit that they're actually a part of the Navy.
Okay.
It just
okay.
seems weird that he's so it's just a mask that the robot was never even wearing at any point. Right?
Yeah. Like, was said to have been wearing.
Suddenly is a goat.
Yeah. Okay, Jeff, naming conventions aside, your thoughts on a tactical robotic goat.
Didn't this look like the Boston Dynamics dog?
Oh, 100%.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Exactly like it.
So I think when I first saw it, I think a lot of questions come up, and this is just a prototype, so I'm not trying to bury it or anything like that, but there's a lot of things that would still need to be figured out. Like one of the things that was impressive when they were doing the demonstration, there was somebody just picking it up and carrying it. Mm-hmm. Now, it would have to be lightweight for the applications they're talking about, but what happens then when you put some Kevlar on this thing, because it's going to be in a battlefield environment? Okay. Yeah. So what about that? They talked about remote firing capabilities, having the soldier close by. Well, what's the range on that? And how is that going to be affected? Again, if you're putting all of this other stuff on this robot, how is that going to impact wireless transmission? How is it going to target? All of those things still have to be worked out. So it is interesting. I think one of the applications that they're potentially not paying attention to that would be, especially if it is a little bit larger type of robot, is in terms of assisting personnel, injured personnel off the battlefield as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. All of this, I think, is leading to the fact that this is the first part, right? This is the ultimate thing that leads to a thing in terms of when we talk about these types of developments, especially for the military. I think it's a really interesting first step, too, because for robotics in the military, I would say most of them, 80, 90% of them have tracks of some sort. Mm-hmm. We've seen stuff that they use for minesweeping. We've seen different things that they're using for positioning, weapons guidance, all of that type of stuff, and it always has a track on it. So to see this one being able to sort of maneuver around different terrain mm-hmm. on feet, if you want to call them that.
Yeah.
Was also very interesting. So great, great starting point. A lot of questions still to be answered.
Well, and up until the point where these were weaponized, and I'll get into that a little bit more. The one combat scenario that they talked about these robot dogs being capable of was tending to wounded that were in the battlefield. And, what were your initial reactions when you saw this demonstration?
Okay, well, first of all, I agree with you both. The first thing that I thought was, that is Spot the robot dog.
Yeah.
How come he's not a dog anymore? He's a goat. How did this happen? Why is it a he? It's not alive. it does not have a gender. It is a robot. I apologize. anyway, but because of that, because of the similarity with what Spot looked like, which was obviously the quadruped robot designed by, was it Alphabet initially, right?
I think Boston Dynamics, but Alphabet bought them.
Okay, so yeah. Boston Dynamics has already been deployed, right, in many different applications, including plant inspections, oil rig, preventive maintenance type roles, even police work. What I most took away from this application with the military was maybe that these quad bots have been most suited for this all along. we know that the biggest need is potentially dangerous applications, but we also know that you have to tread lightly, I think, when incorporating these into human-facing or human-adjacent roles. Like, we saw a huge backlash when the NYPD tried to hire some of these goats or dogs.
So is it a herd? A pack?
A herd of...
A herd of robot... police robot goats?
Yeah, mm-hmm. essentially. Citizens at the time were saying, like, this is dystopian, it's dehumanizing, it's militarization of the police. People were worried about, identification problems, the same kind of stuff you get with AI and facial recognition. What are you going to get from this? So I do think that it kind of raised a lot of questions about like how meticulous do we need to be in the deployment of these? What's actually the right application? Just because it can do all these things, is it going to work for these? The military is all business. While I know that there are still concerns around like how you're going to weaponize an an autonomous robot, of course they need to have a lot of safeguards in place there. But I don't think there is as much worry about how a robot would profile or interact with someone because it's a very specific application. It's, you know, it's not like it's roaming the streets trying to give you a parking ticket or whatever that was about. It's just seems to me like it's an application that can well support automation, and this is probably a good tactic for it.
It is a good tactic for it, but it was one that all the robotics companies got together late last year and said, we're never going to do. And so, according to the Military Times, the platform appears to be something called the Go One robot dog, which is made by the Chinese robotics company Unitree, which is available for about $4,000 on Amazon, or you can buy it from their website, right? So, late last year, in October of 2022, a group of robotics companies pledged to not, quote, weaponize their most advanced robotics. And that group included Agility Robotics, which is building that new plant full of manufacturing robots, Anybotics. They mostly do, I think Anybotics are the ones doing like exoskeletons that are helping people walk. Boston Dynamics, Clearpath Robotics, Open Robotics, and Unitree was the sixth logo on the letter saying, never going to do it. And I don't know, once we started seeing these robot applications come out, everyone was immediately afraid of that, right? Mm-hmm. Just like, don't weaponize it, don't militarize it. And they're just like, no. And I believe we've talked about it on this panel. We're like, hey, that's where the money is. You know, like you can say no all you want when it's in R&D, but if you're going to commercialize it, it's probably going to be for a military application. And it was wild to me. And I mean, you have no control over what someone is going to do after they buy your robot on Amazon, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like the military can buy it on Amazon, strap a rocket launcher to it, and boom, you got a weaponized robotic goat all of a sudden. Also kind of like weirdly the plot of the Iron Man franchise in terms of...
Well, weaponizing robotics.
Yeah, correct. Certainly. But no, so I was just... I pulled this one section out of the open letter that they all signed, you know, about just over a year ago, mm-hmm. where they said, we pledge that we will not weaponize our advanced mobility, general purpose robots, or the software we develop that enables advanced robotics. And we will not support others to do so. We understand that our commitment alone is not enough to fully address these risks. And therefore, we call on policymakers to work with us to promote safe use of these robots and to prohibit their misuse. It was just, I don't know. It was shocking and not shocking all the same that was less than a year or about a year ago now. And here we are with a robot dog with a rocket launcher on it.
Hey, I think you can define things differently. I'm not trying to split hairs here. Okay.
Split them. Let's split them.
David is fired up.
I'm not fired up.
He's fired up.
I'm not yet. Hold on. I'll get some coffee. I'll fire up.
I mean, like I said, I don't want to split hairs too much on the definition, but they're not creating the weaponry. Okay. Mm-hmm. They are providing the vessel, if you will, mm-hmm. for adding it on. So you can't stop people from doing that. I mean, look what they do with vehicles. GM is not necessarily looking to produce a tank or anti-aircraft, missile hauling vehicle, but you can take their chassis and you can definitely do that. And a lot of companies do.
Yeah.
So I think I don't know where these folks are coming from. I get what they're trying to say, but I think they can also skirt that line if they choose.
Oh,
I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
But the other thing, when you talk about, they don't want to make, we talked about it being the most lucrative field to go into with robotics. In a lot of ways, and I think Anna was just talking about this, it's also kind of the most practical when you look at the real world impact that it can have mm-hmm. in terms of saving lives.
I'm just, when you go out and we talk about this new technology that we're going to have control over, what does this sound like to you guys also? Like something that's in the news right now that we're not going to let get out of control, that's going to be fine because we're going to regulate it and we're not going to use it for the wrong thing.
But I agree with Jeff that the robot's the vessel. It's not like the robot can automatically fire a rocket launcher on its own. That's not
I understand right now. It's a guy with a remote control right now.
To me, it's like, how is that different than like the drone stuff that's already happening?
Well, no, exactly. Like, I mean, that is, it is exactly like that. But I'm just saying that to me, this mirrors what they're saying about AI right now, where it was a brand new technology with this new robotic technology. And I don't even like, I mean, I bet if you went back to the origins of drone technology, they're like, we're not going to weaponize it. It's just, it's an ongoing constant pledge when there's a new technology that we're not going to militarize it. And then it's like, oh no, we're going to militarize it.
So, but I don't agree with that the tech, the robot is being
right,
like militarized itself. It is like, what is the, would you rather have a human being walking that out and into a battlefield setting? Like, I think that's the point.
Yeah.
Is that we would rather destroy a robot in this process than destroy a person in this process. It's not like the robot is responsible for making the decision to pull the trigger. They're not.
Yet.
Well, I think that's
a slippery slope, but that's not what's happening here is my point.
I understand. It's not what's happening here yet.
No, David, I think you're misapplying the, it's not the
I'm just speculating.
Yeah.
I'm just speculating.
I think there is again that line between the technology and the application. Just because you develop the technology, you can't control people use it or apply it.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's how I started all this, right? Is that they likely bought it off of Amazon and then you can trick it out however you want. Yeah. But it was just, you know, I mean, because they're having talks right now about how AI will be used for good.
Well, it will.
I know.
But you can't stop bad people from doing bad things either.
I know.
So you think we should just throw all of it in the ocean and forget about it?
There's enough waste in the ocean, Jeff.
Bury it in the desert, whatever.
You can recycle it. There's probably some high quality metals in these things. Batteries aren't cheap. All right. Our most popular story this week. Sonoma Brands wins $21 million from machine builder that sunk the Smashmallow. Smashmallow was a startup backed by food investment firm Sonoma Brands. As the company looked to scale, it turned to Tannis Food Tech, a Dutch machine builder. Tannis Food Tech delivered the Smashmallow machine in late July 2019. It cost some $3 million. When it was first installed, the line produced so much toxic dust that a third-party consultant said that it was an explosion hazard. According to Brownhage and Borden, the law firm that represented Sonoma Brands, in a subsequent lawsuit, Tannis Food Tech didn't fix the dust issue for more than a year, and it had many other problems. For example, the machine produced a, quote, hippopotamus-sized amount of waste every day, which is about 4,000 pounds in spent marshmallows. Perhaps the biggest problem was that it couldn't hit promised production goals of 2,200 pounds per hour. It averaged closer to 844 pounds per hour. Pretty much every significant component had to be replaced or reworked just to get the machine to hit that 844 mark, and the repairs cost another $1 million. At one point, Smashmallow had more than two dozen employees, all of whom had to be laid off because the machine simply didn't work. The company shuttered in 2022. Because the machine took a year to build and install, finding a replacement machine wasn't an option, and the company tried to work with co-packers, but none could achieve the volume and efficiency that Tannis promised the marshmallow startup. Sonoma Brands sued the machine manufacturer, and last week, a jury in Santa Rosa, California, awarded $21 million in damages. Anna, your thoughts on the machine that sunk the Smashmallow?
This story is just absolutely crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, I guess on the one hand, you think like good lesson to not hinge your entire business on one machine. But, you know, maybe they exhausted, you know, you talked about some of the challenges they were up against there. It's like if they're trying to scale and they can't do it by hand.
Yeah, I mean, because this was it. I mean, they were handmade.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all the eggs are in one basket. And what do you do like once you're 3 million in? Is it like, do we continue to try to make it work?
Right.
Or do you try to find somebody else to try and make it work? I don't know. It's a difficult situation.
Well, and it sounds like I don't know if it was a jury trial or not, but whoever made this verdict decision agreed that, you know, that this company was really the one that was at fault here. So what was a little strange to me is that Smashmallow, that's what it's called? Smashmallow?
Yeah, it's Smashmallow. or Smash Mallow.
Mallow.
The former marshmallow company.
Smash Mallow has been shut down since 2022, right? You said? But you would not necessarily know that. I looked online just to like get some more information about it. And it seems like this company is like frozen in time. They didn't take anything down. They still have a Facebook page. They still have an Amazon store where everything says out of stock.
Out of stock, yeah.
Yeah, they're listed on Walmart, Uber Eats. According to reports after this all played out, the verdict resulted in, quote, a sense of redemption for the former company stakeholders, their executives. So you kind of wonder what's next. So Noma Brands, as you mentioned, they have a huge footprint in food. They do a ton of food companies, a lot of kind of new and novel stuff. But they also have some big brands like that Crave beef jerky.
Oh, yeah.
There's a big company that makes cookies and cakes that advertises heavily on social media. So you kind of wonder, like, do they consider reprising the Smash Mallow now that they have all this money to work with? Milk Bar, that's what it's called.
Yeah.
Or do they run screaming from confectionery because this was such a terrible experience? And you know, for Tannis Food Tech, I kind of ask a similar question, like, as to what the impact this had on the psyche of this company. I mean, their core business model is custom machinery for food companies. Mm-hmm. And this was such a disaster that it tanked an entire company. They owe for future lost business millions of dollars. And to me, that's like, that's got to scare you to your core if you're running that company about that potentially happening again. Like, is that... Or your engineering department, is that like a cultural death blow to your engineering department? They probably just feel like, how do we move forward from that? And then not to mention your customers and your prospects seeing that and thinking like, what if we were in that same situation? I would walk away from that company if it were me. You know, that would be just too big of a risk potentially. So it was just in general a sad story because obviously probably... Tannis Food Tech went into this with the best of intentions. They're an established company. They already make machinery. It's not like they're just some fly-by-night, but maybe didn't realize at the outset that they were not equipped to do this, or maybe they thought they could figure it out along the way because it had such a big price tag. I know that happens sometimes, but many people on both sides of it really got screwed here.
Yeah, well, and... Tannis Food Tech was acquired by another company called Orange Works back in 2020. So you kind of wonder if, like, when that acquisition happened and they're looking at their current projects and they look at this machine and they're just like, ooh, so not close, huh? But I mean, we got to see some of the footage that was provided by the law firm. And, you know, you can almost hear like the defeat in the workers who are recording it on their cell phone where it's just like, you know, it's not coming through. Marshmallow is not coming through evenly. It's broken. You know, and if you look at the Smashmallow, it is it's like a, I don't want to say boutique item, but like, you know, it's perfect. You know,
like
it's
a perfect, square, right?
Yeah. It's a perfectly dusted cube. And that was one of the problems. They couldn't even get the flavor dust on it. So Jeff, your thoughts on what happened with this entire situation and, you know, should Smashmallow have seen the writing on the wall and at some point just kind of said like, you know, cut and run?
Yeah, these agreements are very difficult because you've got two companies sharing a lot of proprietary information. They really have to open the books up to create this stuff. Now, what's alarming to me is Tannis had worked specifically with a lot of baking and confectionery companies heading into this project. So they knew, number one, the margins are super tight. They knew the size of this company and the scope of their reach. It wasn't like they're working with Nabisco or something. These weren't graham crackers that they were trying to crank out here. So this is a highly customized machine that had never been made before.
Yeah.
So what you would have think would have made to sort of put in place to protect against something like this is a more progressive or step-by-step type of process in integrating this into production for both Tannis and Sonoma Brands. So that if this wasn't working out, you didn't have all your sort of eggs in one basket in terms of how you're going to produce product. Because for Tannis to see this type of waste that it was creating, they knew better from the start. There's no way with their experience in food production that they could have seen. I mean, these were some crazy numbers in terms of the 4,000 pound block of waste on a daily basis.
Yeah.
It was even more than that when it came to the sprinkles. I forget the number. It was like astronomical amount, 800, whatever it was. So they knew that that wasn't going to fly. They knew that that was not a long-term solution. So it should have been a constant process, especially when you're talking about seven figures for one piece of equipment.
Yeah.
This isn't even putting packaging. This isn't putting ingredients management into it. There was other equipment that also needed to be put in place for this to become a fully automated process to help Smashmallow scale up and get out in the volume that they were looking to do. So it's really disappointing that Tannis did not see that. There's a little bit of shared responsibility on Smashmallow, though. They should have seen this earlier, you would hope. But then again, when you've got all of your money basically invested in this machine because this is what's going to be what takes you to the promised land,
yeah,
you can appreciate getting blindsided and trusting this manufacturer who's telling you, we've been there.
Yeah.
We've done this.
Have a pedigree.
We got this.
Yeah.
So really, like Anna said, really tough situation. That just probably could have been handled a little better on both ends, but Tannis really dropped the ball here.
Well, and one of the things, Tannis Food Tech, and we'll get into that. One of the things about the brands that Sonoma Brands invest in is that they are sort of like they're premium brands, right? So I think that maybe there was a little bit more wiggle room there because you are dealing with like a marshmallow, which is cheap. You know, I mean, you could get a bag of marshmallows that aren't dusted with churro for like a dollar. And, you know, they come in this terrible cylinder shape. But, you know, so maybe there was a little bit more room there to, like, deal with the error. But, I mean, obviously it's a startup, so there's not a lot of money flying around. So I will say that, like, there were a lot of problems with this story. Like, in terms of, like, how it continued to evolve from when it was sent to me and how the information was conveyed to me as I asked follow-up questions trying to put this story together. And I will say that all those problems are my fault because when I asked the questions and got an answer, I didn't follow up and say, are you sure? But so the first time we reported the story, I said Tannis. And there are two Tannises in the Netherlands. There is Tannis now, which is formerly Tannis Confectionery. And there is Tannis Food Tech, which was acquired by Orange Works. So apparently in the Netherlands, the Tannis family was like highly regarded in the confectionery industry, right? Yeah. They're like huge. About 30 years ago, there were two brothers that went their separate ways. Mm-hmm. Leo founded the company now known as Tannis, formerly Tannis Confectionery, and they specialize in gummy and jelly processing. His brother Peter established Tannis Food Tech with a focus on marshmallows. These companies operated independently and have no affiliation through a holding structure. When I confirmed the machine builder, I was told Tannis. And so we ran with Tannis, and then when I was told Tannis and I confirmed, I Googled Tannis in the Netherlands and they came up. Yeah. You guys, like, it didn't say like, hold on a second.
Yeah.
There are two. But I will admit, like, I got that wrong, and we've had to fix it as a result. So just check and double check. But it was a wild story to me that kind of, like, it reminded me of, like, the Farm and Fleet Farm story. Is that specific to the Midwest? I don't know how far the reach is.
Yeah, it's pretty upper Midwest, I think.
Okay. But just, like, how there was this legacy family company, you know, built in candy, and then there was just, like, a brother that's like, no. I'm not doing your gummies and jellies. I'm doing marshmallows. And he's just like, well, fine, you can go do it over there. And as a result, there was like this divide, but like they still have like so much sway in the industry because they do like a ton of business. They are synonymous with gummy and jelly processing equipment. And I mean, up until this, like Tannis Food Tech, you know, they were huge in this sort of equipment. It was just... it has been rare for me to cover a story that has continued to evolve like this on mm-hmm. a daily basis, where it's just like, oh, okay, well, this is like kind of almost true. And so I just wanted to take a minute and like apologize to everybody involved and thank the people that have helped me kind of check the facts, particularly the marketing department of Tannis, formerly Tannis Confectionery, who posted a rectification press release because it was reported incorrectly in multiple outlets as well. So just wanted to make sure that we had the record straight there. Also, like, and as you know, I know a lot of, we know those like small machine builder firms, right? Like, I guess I don't know the full, like, how big Tanis Food Tech was at the side, but at this time, but like you have these huge projects that are worth millions of dollars. And like that monopolizes like all your time or like an entire team's worth of time. And so, I mean, I feel like they were quite vulnerable as well if this project was not going according to plan. And, you know, we had a lot of people comment on the site, aside from the errors, that they need, like, that you really need to be careful when you're reading those contracts, just in terms of what you promised to deliver. And, you know, make sure there's, you know, it's all black and white, just because it can get tricky.
Well, I think the one thing Tanis Food Tech still has going for them is once you find one of these manufacturers who can make this specific equipment, so their existing customers, they're probably golden with them.
Yeah.
Where this is really going to hurt them is obviously finding new business and growing their company, growing their customer base.
All right. Before we move on to, in case you missed it, we got another word from our sponsor, this banger of a podcast Jeff and I put together. One of the long-lasting impacts of COVID-19 and the global pandemic it created has been the priority now being placed on long-term enterprise rides planning.
Almost there, bud.
Yeah, I got it. I got it. So you can join me as I stumble over words and Jeff, who's better with words.
More gooder.
As we discuss Oracle NetSuite's latest white paper, The Ultimate Guide to Scenario Planning, we're going to give you the strategies and steps that you can take to de-risk your organization. You can find the link to register for the event below. You can also find it in the live chat. Sign up now and let us know what you think. Let's move on to, in case you missed it, stories maybe not as popular on the website, but still stand to make a big impact on the industry going forward. Anna, what do you have for us this week?
Not as popular. I don't know why. welding companies scolded for trying to pay settlement in coins.
This is a deadline, not popular, right? So this is a, like, we put together the top five stories and this popped. Like, so this is popular, just not, it's like Wednesday night popular.
Yeah. Yep. It was in the gap.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, a Colorado judge chastised a welding company that tried to pay off a $23,500 settlement with a subcontractor by sending the money in loose coins that weighed 3 tons.
Yeah.
Judge Joseph Finley ruled that JMF Enterprises acted maliciously and in bad faith by delivering a custom-made metal box containing the coins that was too heavy to be carried in the freight elevator at the offices for Fired Up Fabrications lawyers, let alone with the forklift required to carry it, according to court filings. So Finley, the judge, ordered JMF to pay by a more conventional method, like a check.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
You have to give an example of what that is.
Yeah.
Like a check, perhaps.
Like a check. Paper money.
Yeah. Wire transfer. Any of those. He also said JMF would now have to write a larger one to pay an extra estimated $8,000 to cover legal fees for the ensuing dispute over whether it had the right to pay in coins, which sounds like it didn't. So one of the subcontractors, lawyers, Danielle Beam, told Denver's KCNC-TV, which first reported the judge's order, that the coin payment was a, quote, symbolic middle finger.
A 3-ton middle finger.
Yeah.
No kidding.
Huh? Yeah.
Thanks,
I know.
For specifying.
Like, we know.
Not clear.
Oh, we're trying to get to the bottom of it.
We know. And I think that's why this story stood out to me for, in case you missed it, because our regular podcast listeners know that this is not the first time that we've covered a payment in coins that's been done to send a message in some sort of dispute. And to be honest, like, it's really getting old.
These weren't covered in oil, at least.
Yeah, okay, whatever. It's like
the fact that it weighed, what, 3 tons?
3 tons, yeah.
Come on.
I mean, it's clearly intimidation. It's embarrassing to your business. Personally, I wouldn't want to deal with a business who operated it this way if you know their first response to any sort of conflict is petty and personal.
Mm-hmm.
I just think collectively we need to call it on the symbolic middle finger. Like, whatever happened to just like rolling your eyes and moving on with your life? Let's go back to that. And this is ridiculous. I can't believe that we're covering another story about this.
Well, okay, so I do, like, other than my belief that you should be able to pay in whatever legal currency you want to, however logistically difficult.
But
I will say, like, with this story, the caveat for me was that they used to be good friends.
Yeah.
Like, they were very close friends before this lawsuit. So it's a different, that enters, like, a different level for me, where it was like, it could have been something where, you know, he thought he was messing with somebody that he had a personal relationship with, and all of a sudden he's getting litigious. So that was the only part for me, right? Like, the last time the guy was paid in pennies, you know, it was a dispute over somebody who was hired to do a job and then had to make a payment, not too close friends. That was the only caveat for me where I was just like, it looked like somebody that was, you know, maybe trying to razz somebody that he thought he knew really well, and then all of a sudden he got some papers.
This is like some Johnny Knoxville thing, you think?
Like, no, not Johnny Knoxville, but just like
super funny prank, and then the guy took it the wrong way.
I think so. I think like he thought he had a personal relationship with him, so like, you know, he was trying to
court settlement.
Huh? What? I mean, I understand that, but that's the only thing. That's the only part that stood out to me where it was just like, okay, there's a better understanding for me. It wasn't just like some random company that did business for him, and he's like, I'm paying him in pennies because of the settlement.
Here's the bigger issue for me. I understand when you're mad because you just lost a court case. You have to pay out $23,000. Was that what it was? Something mm-hmm. like that?
Yeah.
And you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to pay this guy in pennies just to piss him off.
Yeah.
There's got to be someone else in that room who's like, take a breath.
Yeah.
You don't actually want to do that because it's going to cost us a couple $1,000 just to deliver.
Just to deliver the pennies.
3 tons of pennies. True. Why would we want to do that?
Yeah.
And the fact that that individual who was in charge of doing that wasn't surrounded or didn't choose to surround themselves by someone who's a little more level-headed.
Yep.
Because if you tried to do that, whether it's your wife or somebody in the office or one of your brothers or somebody would be like, okay, David, we get it. But you can't do that.
Yeah.
You know you can't
pay,
do that.
Pay like 1% of the settlement in pennies.
Yeah.
You know, just like hand them the check and then a sack of pennies.
Right.
You know, like there's a bridge, but I don't know, like have they started selling shirts? Like the last time we did the story, you know, they they tried to capitalize on it a bit by selling the I can't remember what it said.
Ugh, just no.
No, I understand.
I doubt that repair shop is still in business.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, sometimes you hope that those in our business community can take the higher ground, but sometimes it's 3 tons of probably pennies, you know?
3 tons of copper.
Yeah. All right. Jeff, you're in case you missed it this week.
So I must have some sort of theme. I keep picking these like renewable energy stories, but I picked this one. The headline is several hundred thousand clean energy jobs are estimated for EV battery storage and solar energy. And what this comes down to is the Inflation Recovery Act, the IRA that was signed into law last August. Basically, the article is about a nonpartisan business group that nonpartisan being the important thing here, because we definitely had some comments on the site that were trying to put us in a corner of taking sides or something here. But this is from a nonpartisan business group that advocates for clean energy. And they're estimating that over 400,000 jobs will be created by the 210 major energy projects announced since the Inflation Reduction Act took effect last year. At least $86 billion in investments have been announced, with the biggest job gains expected in electric vehicles, battery storage, and solar energy sectors. Now, this caught me for two reasons. Number one, we're seeing a government program, in theory, doing exactly what it's supposed to do in terms of creating a lot of jobs in energy where we need them, okay? The OEMs are saying, we're going forward with electric vehicles. We need to figure out how to do supply batteries, recycle batteries. We said we want to move forward to support all of this new stuff on the grid with different energy sources, like solar. So we got 35,000 jobs going into solar. The two things that are a little bit alarming to me, however, is that when we talk about these 35,000 jobs specifically associated with solar energy, as we've talked about the last couple of weeks, we've got all this great technology for producing the power we need. We still don't have a lot of conversations on the infrastructure to deliver it and to bring it in, make it cost effective. That wasn't really addressed here. And I understand this is first steps. We're a year into this program. We're just getting going. But I'd still like more specifics when it comes to a lot of these government programs and funding going, that's great, you can make it. Mm-hmm. But we need to have some of this money, not just going into the company that's going to be producing this stuff and doing it, but delivering it and making sure we have infrastructure in place to connect, get everything connected and use it the right way. The other thing when I see about all of this money, okay, going from a government program, I start thinking about a lot of those COVID-19 checks. So we're looking at $86 billion so far.
Yeah.
I just hope we're doing the right things. I was shocked actually when I checked the comments that I didn't see some sort of reference to Solyndra
yeah.
And all that debacle. But again, I want to be positive. I want to be optimistic that this is going in the right direction. I just hope we've learned our lessons along the way in terms of making sure we're connecting to this power and that we're making sure these folks are doing what they say they're going to do and not just setting up dummy companies to siphon off of a government program.
Yeah.
So hopefully this is like the next time we talk about the IRA, we're talking about, again, all the good things that it's done. Yeah. I know a lot of people want to point out the name of this act too for some reason as opposed to talking about what it's doing. It's called the Inflation Reduction Act. And a lot of readers were like, I haven't seen any change in inflation. Fair enough.
Yeah.
However, this part of it was not about that. This is also a report, again, from a nonpartisan group. Mm-hmm. We are not saying President Biden has just hit a home run here. We're saying we're off to a good start.
Yeah.
And let's see where it goes.
It's a hot take. It's a real hot take. No.
Hey, I'm as Republican as they come in here. And like, that those things annoy me because all we're doing is saying this is what was produced and reported and people want to paint us in a corner.
Yeah. Thanks for your Bidenomics.
Right.
No, I do hope that, you know, the COVID-19 funds, those were like emergency disbursements. And I understand that a lot of people took advantage of them. I hope that things are a little bit more careful, that they take a little bit more time, but, maybe that's too much optimism. Especially given how many of those stories just in the industrial sector recovered.
Yeah.
But who knows? Anna, your thoughts on Jeff's story this week?
Yeah, I agree that it's, you know, there's a lot of good to come out of this and it needs to be tracked effectively. But yes, I think that in order for, I think it's like a good, it's a good reminder that, the clean energy movement is not just about like shutting things down and killing the oil industry. And, you know, there's stuff that's coming in to replace some of those jobs, like coal's probably going away. But, you know, that doesn't mean that those jobs necessarily are just like becoming coal dust. They're just different. And there's a lot of positive things about that transition to be lauded as well.
Well, a lot of what the article talks about, too, is sort of the things that happen on the periphery when you make these investments. When, again, you're talking about energy sources, you're talking about batteries, cars, all that kind of stuff. There's also stuff on the periphery that's not directly sponsored by these programs, mm-hmm. but we'll see benefits from it as well.
So. Yeah. All right. My In Case You Missed It this week was an insider Q&A that I did with Matt Jones, who is the general manager at Micropsy Industries. The AI experts at Micropsy Industries recently partnered with Deprag, an international industrial tool supplier, to create an automated screwdriving solution. Now, it seems simple, but automating screwdriving assembly processes has proven elusive despite advances in industrial robotics. Micropsy developed Mirai, an AI-powered robot control system that works with any industrial robot or collaborative robot or cobot. The system uses cameras and sensors to react in real time in dynamic workspaces. Mirai has been in development for about 5 years. The first screwdriving application came about 3 years ago. Basically, a customer came to Micropsy because of a failing robot solution. As you can imagine, driving a screw into a lighting fixture can quickly make a mess on the manufacturing floor if you don't line it up with the pilot hole. That's what Jones told me in the interview. Part of the problem is that screws are highly reflective and vary in shapes and size. You know, that's No two screws are the same. This customer was able to keep their existing robot cell and simply add this Mirai solution to the setup in a matter of a couple of hours. And then there was some additional training as well. Now, there is obviously a cost, but Jones said that it's a lot cheaper than making bad parts. And part of it isn't the cost of waste, but he kind of stressed that, you know, this solution can help with labor costs. Customers say that the value is largely in making good parts. I chose this story this week because I really appreciated Jones's insight into an industry where they're trying to automate the unautomatable using AI. And it's kind of wild that like a process as basic as driving a screw can't be automated, right? Yeah. And how they can put this AI solution on any industrial robot or cobot in any sort of work cell and train it to do an application that otherwise was pretty labor intensive. And I mean, there are a number of other things that I would encourage everybody to read this interview. There are a number of reasons that you would want screwdriving as well, just because ergonomically, it's one that has a high injury rate just in terms of repeatable maneuvers. The other is that, so one of the problems with AI, right, is that it gets bad information, right? So one of the problems with ChatGPT is that not only is it like plagiarizing, but it's pulling from every source of the internet. And I mean, hey, there are some not even dark holes of the internet that's just giving out bad info.
Yeah.
So the AI only works or is only trained under a specific setting when you're saying, I'm training you. So that way it's not just pulling all the data, it's just pulling the data you want it to. And I thought that was also a really powerful solution in terms of how we could make these industrial robots and cobots a little bit smarter. I don't know if either of you guys had a chance to read this Q&A yet. I mean, it just kind of went out, but I thought this was a pretty cool application. And when it comes to fastening and assembly applications, kind of, there's a whole world out there that's waiting for automation.
There is, yeah. I love this kind of stuff too, because it really illustrates the fact that some of this stuff is super off the shelf. Yeah. And I know that in manufacturing, especially, you know, there's so much fear around incorporating new technology because of this fear of downtime and like putting something to the side to try to get this in place. And what if it doesn't work, or what do I have to swap out all this stuff? And for you be able to apply this to just any, you know, existing robot line is pretty incredible. And I think people need to hear about that stuff more to understand like, hey, there's a really practical application. It can be applied easily and it's actually available to you. You're, you know, maybe you're a smaller business and you think that this stuff doesn't apply to your business. Well, you know, here's how it does.
Yeah. Well, and I encourage people to check out the photos of these applications. We just have two photos on the site, but how, you know, you think about mounting cameras and sensors to a robot and it's going to be overly complicated, but it's not.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, isn't that one of the most frustrating things, though, with screws?
Yeah.
You drop it, you can't quite get the match up to the head if the head's not magnetic. I mean, it can be very frustrating. And to have an application like this where you're taking two technologies that quite honestly get a ton of scrutiny in terms of where they fit in the industrial environment, robotics and AI, and to see them come together and be married sort of perfectly for a super practical application. It's not like this is something that's just way out there tech for something.
We don't need that.
Yeah, something that's crazy communications or military device. This is literally something that every single plant floor on the planet could use. So this is amazing.
Yeah, it's not just screwdriving, nut running, bolt driving applications. So he was targeting or talking about small electronic components, everything from manufacturing a small electronic component to a large airplane wing. You know what? We should just call it on this episode. No, there's applicability. So I'm just I was inspired by this interview, his thoughts on how it all came together and the potential that it holds for the industry going forward. Instead of like me just picking it in case you missed it, where I'm like, this will be fun to kind of talk about. Mm-hmm. I was like, no, this one's really going to have an impact on the industry going forward. All right. Before we get out of here, let's jump into our final thoughts before we get smoked out of this hot, hot studio. Anna, what's your final thought this week?
I will be attending a trade show next week for STAFTA. That's, the Specialty Tools and, Fasteners Distribution Association. It's a long one.
Nailed it.
Yeah.
Ooh, well done.
Fasteners. And that is in San Antonio. So I will be meeting with some companies. If you're going to be at the show, find me. I'll be at a table marked Industrial Distribution. It's by registration.
How much Tex-Mex will you eat next week?
So much. I am in so many unlimited baskets of chips and salsa. Bring them to me. Keep bringing them.
San Antonio is one of the best food towns that we go to.
I love going to San Antonio, and I will try to stay out of the water.
Agreed. Like I want to like counterpoint that, but yeah, no, San Antonio is great. It's so you guys are both out next week. Are you going to be back?
I will be back for the podcast. Don't worry.
Okay. Anna coming in off the road to the podcast. So
yeah, I take my commitment seriously. So I will be here for the podcast.
I'm all about me. Whatever's easiest for me, that's what I do.
Jeff is gonna like host his own podcast while he's out at Rockwell. Yeah. Just like Jeff Ranky's Today in Manufacturing podcast. Way different. Way different. My final thoughts this week is that I donated blood this morning. Probably not the best idea when we had a couple of interviews and a podcast recording. But hey, pushing fluids and snacks, and it seems to be working mostly.
Are you lightheaded? Are you fine?
I had a couple of, like, I took that big swig of coffee after I said I needed to punch up a little bit, and I was just like, ooh, all right, need a little more water. Just like every once in a while, I don't know how much of us is on camera, but like, I like had to clutch it. You know, I'm just like, hang on for a second. Okay, we're all right.
That's a great Ric Flair right there.
But lightheadedness aside, there is a tremendous blood shortage in this nation, in the world. And I know that I've said it before, but I was lucky enough to have a blood drive that is two doors down from us. But if you have any time in your schedule, doesn't matter what kind of blood you have, there's a huge need for it. So get out there and donate blood if you can, just because, you know, you might not be using it now, but you're going to need it sometime, which is, I feel like I'm just banking it. You know, I'm just like
karma, like, blood karma.
Yeah. Well, like I have, you know, I give them my blood donor card and I feel like when I need it, I just give it to them. And I'm like, okay, you can see how many pints I have deposited and those are all available for me now. Right.
Hopefully you don't have to take out a bunch at once.
Yeah. I hope it's not like a kind of like a social security sort of situation for our generation. Jeff, your final thought this week.
Well, as you mentioned, I'll be at the Rockwell Automation Fair next week. Looking forward to that. That's always a fun event. A lot of great stuff going out there. So yeah, swing by. I'll be on the floor. We also had some great responses to the question I posed last week about the video games. You know, for my birthday, I really enjoyed sort of turning the clock back a little bit and going to the arcade. So we asked what some people's favorites would be. And William, who's actually watching here today, he said he would go with Maniac Mansion. Now, that's not one I'm familiar with.
No.
I believe that was more of a console, like computer game as well. I think it was also like Atari type stuff, but definitely fitting for the Halloween that we just celebrated.
Mm-hmm. Gotta play it.
But I'm more of a role player type of thing, which I was, like I said, I wasn't familiar with that one, but hey, I'm sure it looks awesome.
Oh, man.
Anna, you said that one sounded familiar.
It looks familiar to me, some of these scenes, but maybe it's just like the animation style was what everything looked like. I don't know.
Yeah.
But definitely, I mean, the look is definitely from the right era, I guess, with the stuff that I was talking about. So
if you're at Rockwell.
Will, I need your address so I can send you a koozie.
If people see you at Rockwell and approach you and say the thing that leads to the thing.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be like a koozie or t-shirt sort of scenario.
Oh, yeah.
Just like, he's going to have them in like a shirt cannon. Well, you're both going to be on the road. So we need matching Today in Manufacturing shirt and koozie cannons. This is all coming together fast. We're going to have to get on it right away.
We can't do that though, because all the robotics companies don't want to weaponize that kind of stuff.
Thank you, Jeff. And if you see Anna at Stavta, yell, put a rooster on it. And
go ahead. Other games, Jeff?
That are going to be weaponized, which they have been.
Joe also got a hold of us, and he said his game was Cruisin' USA. He has got the nice little arcade. Actually, he sent some pictures of his basement. They're awesome.
He has it in his basement?
He's got a number of consoles in there. He has got Cruisin' USA. Looks like he's got a Pac-Man game. He's also got a claw machine.
No way.
Yeah.
And a Star Wars game as well. So he is crushing it.
Man, do you remember when you would start that game, and it was like, Cruisin'?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
It's one of the first ones where you sat down in and drove. It was awesome. Now, his wife also kicked it up a notch. She, after he got that, she wanted a skee ball machine. So they also have an old school skee ball machine.
Awesome.
In the basement.
Invite us over.
Yeah. Are you close?
Yeah, we are. It's a drive, but it's not crazy. So we might be there tomorrow.
Very cool.
But those were the two. So yeah, thanks for sharing those with us. You know, I was thinking a little bit about another one of these that we could possibly do. With Halloween this week, it got me thinking, we had a ton of candy left over.
Oh, God.
But we bought the type of stuff that I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
You know, it can last a little bit. My daughter, I'm sure, will take care of it. She'll take it to school and all that, which is good, too. But it kind of got me wondering, maybe we've talked about this before, but was there a type of candy that when you got it, either as a kid or you would make sure you avoided handing out as an adult? Because for me, and I know you guys are going to like bash me for this, I hated Sweet Tarts and Smarties.
Oh,
like, man. Those like hard candy. Like, yeah. If I got those were definitely being traded. Or
I'm like salivating. Yeah, because I love those. I love Sweet Tarts so much.
Yeah.
No,
chewy Sweet Tarts.
No.
Those I could handle.
Yeah,
but like the chalky one, I just, none of those, I didn't like any of that.
I thought you were saying like how you position them in the bowl. Like, so if you approach our Halloween candy bowl, it's definitely a layer of the peanut M&Ms at the bottom, the Reese's next, and then like gummy bears and everything else on top, where it's just like, okay, if they get to them, they get to them. But no, we had a ton of leftover candy too, because I was overcompensating for a decade of bad candy. And it has been like, I have not made myself sick on candy for the better part of 30 years. And man, the Day of the Dead Reese's, running. I was like, I had really good intentions to bring them into the office, guys, but sorry.
I get it. Those are the best.
Oh, man. Anna, did you have leftover candy?
Yeah. I brought a bag of it into the office.
Oh, that's... Oh, I didn't know that was the leftovers. I thought that was like the stuff that had already been culled from like the kids' bags.
No, nothing has been culled. That's the... We have just an embarrassment of riches. That was just extra handout candy. So it's bleak over there. Like the bags are full. It's just a constant... like... The kids are like dumping them out and sorting them over and over again and then doing that, like, you know.
That's awesome.
The kids love to sort them. The one that I heard the most, Mitzi in the office has like, for some reason he knows he has 600 pieces of candy left to go. I'm just like, that is weird that you know that exact number, and a lot. Really overshot it. Mm-hmm. Plus we might have some semblance of trivia coming back and a possible giveaway start next week too.
Awesome. Well, in the meantime.
Yeah.
If you do want to share, email me the candy you would avoid or were kind of disappointed with for Halloween. We can get you out a t-shirt or koozie. One of the two.
Most, what are you disappointed
with? Most hated candy. I mean, I hate those marshmallow. I hate marshmallow stuff. So any of that can get tossed.
Are they sugar babies? Sugar babies or sugar daddies? It's probably a baby.
Sugar babies are the small ones like the Skittle size, and the sugar daddy is the sucker.
Okay, both of those. Pass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, before we get out of here this week, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IN.com with email the podcast in your subject line. Make sure to email Jeff the candy you don't like, and then we'll send it to you in the koozie. All right. Well, please make sure to subscribe to us on YouTube at IN Magazine so you can join Seth and William in the live chat, as well as the others that are commenting throughout. For Jeff Ranke and Anna Wells, I'm David Manti. This is the Today in Manufacturing podcast. And we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Today in Manufacturing podcast.